coming up.
Do you know what the doll Barbie said her very first words out of her mouth?
Science and gender.
She said, math class is tough.
Why is science still dominated by men?
If men and women do have different brains, if we have different cognitive skills, we better have everybody being a scientist so that we can perceive all of reality.
What is the feminist critique of science?
It's not rocket science.
Is science inherently sexist?
Isn't the scientific method gender neutral?
Asking a different question is really important.
Our guest is Londa Schiebinger, author of Nature's Body, Gender in the Making of Modern Science.
How can you use the methods of gender analysis to see new things?
Is science the last bastion of a dying patriarchy?
What I'm interested in is the gender bias in the knowledge.
Science and gender.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the Mars Theater, the Bay Area's breeding ground for new performance.
Our thinking originates across the Bay at Stanford University. That's where Ken and I both practice and teach philosophy.
Welcome, everyone, to Philosophy Talk. Today, it's science and gender.
Well, you know, Ken, science used to be pretty much an all-boys club. Back in the 1980s, for example, when students were asked to draw what a scientist looks like, 48% drew a scientist with facial hair, definitely a man. 25% gave their scientist a pocket protector, kind of a male thing. Only 8% drew a woman.
Yeah, you know, John, I recently read an article by one of the first two women to earn an undergraduate degree in physics from Yale. You know when she graduated? 1978. Come on, Yale is over 300 years old.
Well, let's be fair to Yale. They didn't go co-ed until 1969, or does that make it worse?
Still.
Things are a little better than they used to be. Nowadays, for example, when you ask students to draw pictures of scientists, no pocket protectors.
That's progress.
That's progress. A whopping 33% draw women scientists.
Well, that's good. And there's also the fact that a lot of young women study science in high school these days. Many major in science in college. And a lot go on to get PhDs. In fact, in 2009, more women than men earned PhDs in the biological and agricultural sciences, the social and behavioral sciences, and also the health sciences. So that's progress.
Well, I don't want to rain on your parade, but there are areas where men still outpace women. That same year, women had less than a third of the PhDs in math, computer science, physical and earth science, and engineering.
Yeah, you know, and strangely enough, John, though the pipeline of women in science has been steadily improving, it's still the case that more men than women have successful careers in science. After 30 years of determined efforts to increase the number of women in our own faculty in science and engineering at Stanford, only 22% of all senior faculty are women. It's something, yeah, I really don't know how to explain that.
Well, you don't like Larry Summers' explanation, the one he gave when he was president of Harvard?
Oh, God, no, I surely don't want to go there. He got beat up pretty bad for that one, John.
Well, deservedly so. He implied that fewer women than men are likely to have the innate aptitude to do well in science because women are, like he was saying, genetically inferior. That would just be old-fashioned sexism dressed up with crude biological determinism.
In fairness to Summers, he wasn't being quite that crude. I mean, he was claiming that when it comes to intelligence, men cluster much more around the extremes than women do. In other words, men tend to be either really dumb or really smart without much in between, and women tend to cluster more heavily around the mean than men do. That means that there may be a lot fewer really dumb women, but on the other side of that is there are a lot fewer really brilliant women, too. And then he added that people who succeed at science are by and large drawn from the really brilliant end of the spectrum, so it wasn't that crude.
wasn't that crude. It didn't get him a lot of fans. Men can be amazingly obtuse sometimes, and Summers himself witnesses that.
Yeah, you got a better explanation, though?
How about outright sexism? How about cultural stereotypes? How about differences in the way girls and boys are socialized?
But these days, we already said, more and more women are getting PhDs in a whole variety of scientific fields. Doesn't that alone suggest that whatever role sexism used to play, it plays much less of a role than it did back in the old bad old days?
Well, don't fool yourself. Sexism is not dead. It may have gone more underground, that's all.
Well, I'm not sure what you mean, underground sexism. What are you talking
about?
Well,
we do a little experiment. Give two independent hiring committees exactly the same resumes, two aspiring young scientists, identical in every respect, except one is named Roberta, a recognizably female name, and the other one is Robert, a recognizably male name.
That shouldn't make matter at all, should it? I mean, after all, what's in a name, as Shakespeare asks?
Apparently, quite a bit. On trial after trial, the candidate with the female name is judged to be less qualified than the candidate with the male name. Incidentally, this might interest you, the same goes for candidates with recognizably minority names.
Yeah, that's pretty disturbing stuff, John.
And it's not just men who make these calls. It's women, too. Women on the committees, same result. People who wouldn't consciously entertain a sexist thought if you paid them can be completely unaware of their implicit biases. That makes those biases the most insidious kind. They're hard to get rid of, and they work against women in many ways.
Well, so I got a new slogan for you. Implicit biases are the enemies of gender justice. How about that?
It's not just a matter of justice. Science itself is worse off when the voices and perspectives of women and minorities are systematically excluded.
Come on, are you claiming that women and minorities actually make better scientists than white males? Sounds like you've got the gender bias here.
No, that's not the point. Women and minorities may or may not be better individual scientists, but they make science better because the bias in the way it's conducted. Think of all the clinical research. This has been documented. They oversample white males. They radically undersample minorities and women. And it leads to bad results.
I know what you're talking about. This is puzzling. It's challenging stuff. You know, I'm not really sure where even to begin to address these problems.
Well, let's do some consciousness raising. We can do that. We sent our roving philosophical reporter, Caitlin Esch, to ask women scientists about the explicit and implicit biases they face every day. She files this report.
Sometimes gender bias can be subtle, like it was for Jennifer Raymond, a neuroscientist at Stanford.
One time I was speaking in a retreat, and one of my senior male colleagues was introducing the speaker before me, who happened to be a trainee, and went on and on about his scientific talent and the brilliance of his project. And then the same moderator introduced me by saying I was a mother.
Or it could be overt, as it was for women of a slightly older generation. MIT biologist Nancy Hopkins recalls the time she met Francis Crick, the man who co-discovered the structure of DNA. She was a young student at Harvard.
And the door flew open, and standing in the doorway, there was Francis Crick. I recognized him at once. I looked up, and he zoomed across the room, put his hands on my breast, and said, "What are you working on?" And I thought, whoa, this is an awkward situation right here. Well, what do I do here? I've got to get out of this without embarrassing this man.
Hopkins says she was incredibly embarrassed, but it never occurred to her that groping was cause for complaint, so she didn't tell anyone. Later, when Hopkins started her own lab in the 1970s, she started noticing that when women scientists made important discoveries, they weren't as referenced or as valued as their male colleagues.
So you just kept trying harder and harder and harder. And I think it took me 20 years of watching other women and realizing it didn't matter how hard you tried, you couldn't be taken as an equal no matter what you discovered.
And this revelation was a huge blow to Hopkins. She actually thought about leaving science altogether.
It was like trying to fill a bucket that had a hole in the bottom of it. You know, you kept doing more and more work, but the work kept running out the bottom of the bucket.
Hopkins says things have changed a lot since then, but there's still the nagging problem of the unconscious bias. Skidmore College psychologist Corinne Moss-Rakusin has actually documented this.
We were really curious to see whether male and female faculty members, if they were presented with an equivalently qualified male and female science student, would they view those students equally? Would they mentor them equally? Would they evaluate them equally?
So in 2012, Moss Rakusin and her team recruited 130 faculty members at colleges and universities all over the country. They sent them applications from a student who was applying to be a lab manager. Everything in the application was exactly the same, except that half the participants got applications from a female and half got applications from a male. The results were pretty surprising.
When the student is described as female, faculty members rate her as less competent than the identical male student. They're less likely to mentor her, less likely to hire her for a lab manager position. And if they do hire her, they pay her about $4,000 per year less on average than, again, the identical male student.
And this bias wasn't just coming from male faculty. The female faculty members had the same unconscious bias. Stanford professor Jennifer Raymond says the first step toward dealing with the problem is admitting it.
We had made a lot of progress in the 80s and 90s, and then in the last 15 years or so, progress has leveled off. So when I did the calculation in my field in neuroscience, to get to 50-50 gender equity at the faculty level, if we kept going at the rate we're going now, we wouldn't reach 50-50 until sometime in the 22nd century.
Raymond says this isn't just about fairness. We're facing huge problems that science can fix. Climate change, food shortages, disease. And we need to draw from the full scientific talent pool, male and female. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Caitlin Esch.
Thanks, Caitlin, for documenting what Ken and I were talking about, a lot of bias. I'm John Perry, along with my fellow philosopher at Stanford, Ken Taylor. We're coming to you today from the Marsh Theater in Berkeley, California.
Our guest today is a professor of history from Stanford University. She's author of Gender Innovations, How Does Gender Analysis Contribute to Science? Please welcome to the Philosophy Talk stage, Londa Schiebinger.
Londa, you seem to find, well, you do find the interaction of gender and science fascinating. So, which came first? Fascination with science? Fascination with gender? Or did they just come together?
Well, I started with a fascination with gender. I went to graduate school at Harvard, and in my day, there weren't any women professors. And then, interestingly, after the first year, there were no other women graduate students except me, and I got interested in what are the intellectual issues here. So I intended to do something really big on women in philosophy, but at the same time, MIT, where you saw Nancy Hopkins, they did the first series on women in science, and I went and listened, and I heard the women scientists giving the same story over and over. And what they didn't understand is how society or institutions structured their lives and their stories back in the day when I was a graduate student. And I thought, here's where I, the historian of science, can make a contribution.
Well, now, some people think that science itself, taken as it ought to be, taken as it intrinsically is gender neutral. The canons of objectivity and rationality have no trace of gender in them. Other people think that science is in some way deeply gendered. If not explicitly, then at least implicitly. These canons of science, they say, valorize male ways of thinking over female ways of thinking. So what do you think? Is there any sense in which science itself is gendered?
Well, I think you had really great examples of gender bias in science, especially what women scientists are dealing with. But what I'm interested in is the gender bias in the knowledge, in the science. As we're saying, now we could give millions of examples of gender bias, and maybe I'll just give you one. And I'm going to take an example from engineering, and right from Google, which is down the block from us. Mm-hmm. A couple of years ago, I went to Spain, and there were some newspaper articles about me. I came home, I zoomed it through Google Translate, and I was shocked that I was referred to constantly as he. Londa Schiebinger, he thinks, he says, occasionally, it wrote.
God.
Google Translate has a male default. How can such a cool company, in 2014, have a male default? And what's interesting is that he said occurs twice as often on the World Wide Web, as she said. And what we know from another Google product, Ngram, I don't know if you've ever seen it, is that the ratio of he said to she said has fallen dramatically over the past 30 years. And this exactly parallels the women's movement. It parallels massive government funding to increase the number of women in science. And with one algorithm, Google wiped that all out. And they didn't mean to.
It's
completely unconscious gender bias.
Well, that's because they do translation through statistical analysis. It's not, they don't know any grammar. If a person were to do
Oh, sure. Yeah,
You'd be really worried.
No, we're talking about algorithms.
But there is, you'd think there is something hidden from us that distorts science in some ways. And that seems to me pretty undeniable. And we'll have to dig into why that is in our next segment. This is Philosophy Talk, coming to you from the Mars Theater in Berkeley, where we're thinking about science and gender. Our guest is Londa Schiemenger from Stanford University.
Why are women underrepresented in certain areas of science and maybe overrepresented in other areas, home economics maybe? Could it be because science is an essentially gendered activity? Is gender-neutral science conceivable, really possible, even desirable?
Exploring the interaction of gender and science, along with questions from you, our live audience, when Philosophy Talk continues.
She blinded me with science. She blinded me with science. She blinded me with...
science. Thanks to our live musical guests, the Playtones. This is Philosophy Talk. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Our guest is historian Londa Schiemenger, author of Gender Innovations. And we're talking about science and gender.
What role does gender play in shaping scientific inquiry? Might women bring something to science that men cannot? Is a science that systematically excludes or undervalues the perspectives of women necessarily worse as science? Join the discussion by stepping up to the microphone in front of the stage. Women on this side, men on the... I'm just kidding.
So, Londa, I want to start. I mean, there's a lot of issues here, but I want to start to get your take on something that puzzles me a little bit. It may not be the deepest thing, but it does puzzle me. As we said earlier, there are scientific fields where more women than men are earning PhDs these days. But there are other fields in which the reverse is still true, and by a very long shot. I mean, it's not even close. I'm just not sure what to make of the spread of gender across the disciplines, the disparity. Do you make anything of it?
You started talking in your introduction about the stereotypes and the role culture plays in this. And I think kids decide really early on what they want to do. So it doesn't help if the doll Barbie, do you know what Barbie said, her very first words?
No.
Out of her mouth?
No.
She said, math class is tough.
Oh, goodness.
Millions of children, millions of girls own Barbie. What kind of message is this for girls? And we see that girls, women don't go as often into math-based fields, and I think we can look at the many messages that are given in our culture.
So I'm going to give you a chance to knock down the Larry Summers. I assume you would, because the Larry Summers explanation would be, well, you know, those sciences pull from this end of the distribution scale, the other sciences maybe don't, or something like that. I don't know. What do you think of
that? Well, I would like to send Larry Summers a bouquet of spring flowers, because he made his remark, as I took up the leadership, the directorship of the Clayman Institute for Gender Research at Stanford, and we were just having a funding campaign. And let me tell you, the money came pouring in. So, I mean, really, the great thing is people don't go for those innate arguments anymore.
But is there anything, do you think it's all culture? And enculturation, is there anything at all about the difference between men and women's minds, whether or not you put them on some intelligence skills, about men and women's minds that draws them to this range of disciplines versus that range of disciplines? Do you think there's anything to that or not?
That draws them to the disciplines. Well, the science of brains is really not very well developed, so it's hard to say what those things mean. The point is, if men and women do have different brains, if we have different cognitive skills, we better have everybody being a scientist so that we can perceive all of reality.
The Summers, as he actually spoke, as Ken cleared up in the introduction, had a little bit more complex and nuanced point. And as a matter of fact, you do have men over on the low end of the spectrum, not only in education, but all over the place. There's more men in prison, more men commit violent crimes, more boys in remedial classrooms, more boys when we used to do handwriting, teach handwriting, more boys that had such bad small muscle coordination they couldn't even learn to write. And we don't assume that those overrepresentations of males are due either to unfairness on the part of females or to unfairness on the part of men. We think that's just a difference. So isn't it likely that there's some truth in the differences over on the positive side of the spectrum? I'm skating on thin ice here, I know, but you know, more men, I think, are autistic. More men have Asperger's. Might that correlate with being really good at the things that I, who don't have autism or Asperger's, are not very good at, like math and writing symphonies? Was that part of Summers' education? I mean, let's grant that Summers didn't have the whole story. Could he have had a little part of the story?
Well, the interesting thing these days is we don't have to prove sameness in order for people to be equal. I mean, it used to be that when all men are created by nature equal, which is what the Constitution says, they all had to be the same, right? And so a lot of feminism in the 70s and 80s argued for sameness. Now we've gone through the 90s, we started celebrating difference, we understand that more inclusive groups are more creative. There was an article in Science magazine, I think it was 2010, showing that the IQ of a group increases as the diversity of that group goes up because you get different ways of thinking, different ways of communicating, you get different ways that people collaborate, you ask different questions.
So,
and the other thing is you don't want to put women in one little group and talk about women and think they're all the same and put men in a little group because we know economic differences. You're talking about the men in prisons. That's a class issue more than a gender issue. It can be a race issue. We don't want to just collapse divides into men and women. We want to look at the richness of all these populations.
Well, some philosophers think of something they call the scientific method. Maybe that's a caricature. Maybe we should say the methods of science and multiple methods because all kinds of different sciences, the methods of biology are different from the methods of physics and all that. Right, so the multiple methods of science. Now, you might think that those methods, yeah, you want all kinds of minds, but those methods are not intrinsically gendered. They're kind of gender neutral. You just apply them. Men would apply them the same way as a well-trained male scientist would apply them as a well-trained female scientist. Now, John suggested in the opening that, but science itself is improved when you have more voices. Do you think that goes with the idea that there's just one set of fixed methods of science or not?
Yeah, so we've had gendered innovations. This is the word they've been saying about my book, gendered innovations. We've had this project for the last 3 or 4 years across Europe and the United States. And what we've been asking is, how can you use the methods of gender analysis to see new things? So, for example, we know that between 1997 and 2000, 10 drugs were withdrawn from the U.S. market. And 8 of those drugs had worse side effects in women. Now, if scientific methods worked, we wouldn't have wasted billions of dollars and killed lots of people with science.
No, but,
but let me ask a question about that. So I heard the other day on the radio, I mean, my wife and I both take a baby aspirin a day because for years we've been told take a baby aspirin a day. It's a good idea. It'll keep you from having heart attacks. Well, it turns out that's not quite right. Yeah. It's good for men that are going to have heart attacks. Maybe it's good for women that are going to have strokes. But my question is, you know, the budgets involved in coming up with these things are huge. How could they make such a basic mistake as not to sample both? I mean, how does that actually happen? Doesn't the NIH doesn't have protocols that require this?
Did I actually laugh when you said that? So the deal is, I mean, interestingly, last spring, I don't know how many of you use Ambien, Sulpidem, the sleep drug. The thing is that last spring, the FDA, for the very first time, cut the dose for women in half. It's the very first time the FDA recommends a different dose for women and a different dose for men. So the idea is getting through that we need to look at both. So how do why did these drugs fail, the drugs that were withdrawn from the market? Why are we throwing money out the window? It goes back to animal research. So there's drug discovery, and you test it first on mice. And the thing is, I talk to a lot of directors of labs. They say it's too expensive. We can't do male mice and female mice. Sometimes.
Wait a minute.
I know.
That's
so
astounding.
It's a matter of funding. It's a matter of priorities.
Do they just do males, just do females, or they just don't
keep track of which they are? They mostly do males, but often they don't, in fact, write down the sex of the subject. They don't report the sex of the subject, and that's when you've really thrown money out the window because you can't go back and do meta-analysis.
Is that because it costs a lot to have someone who can tell the difference between a male and a female? Male?
They need to hire some
right.
penis sexers.
Right.
Look,
It's just bad science.
We got into that because do you think it's just an implicit gender bias, not made that the male is the default and that whatever applies? I mean, what's going on there? Because if you thought there was a statistical difference between the way these drugs might affect males and females, then you'd be darn sure to make your sample, informative rather than not. So what do you think was going on in their minds? It's
the pesky hormones. If you're going to do animal studies, you need to have males and females, and then you have to have the females in different days of their estrus cycles. Rodents have a four-day cycle, you'll be happy to know. The thing is, when I talk to directors of lab, they say it's just too expensive, and then it's an issue they would like NIH to give them the money so that they can do both males and females. It's not rocket science, they know how to do it.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about science and gender with Londa Schimmiger at the Mars Theater in Berkeley, and we've got a guest from our audience. Welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Hi, my name's Layla. I'm a senior at Berkeley High School right down the street, and I'm actually interested in studying science. Mm-hmm. But I was just wondering if you think that the ways of collecting scientific information and the methods need to change, or how they need to change to encourage more women into the field.
Yeah, so this project that I was talking about a little earlier, Gendered Innovations, we spent 3 years, we had a collaboration of 60 scientists, gender experts, and engineers. We had workshops in Berlin, at Stanford, at Harvard, in Madrid, and all kinds of really fun places. And we hammered out 12 methods of gender analysis, which kind of parallel the scientific method. And what we're trying to do now is to get this stuff into the curriculum so that hopefully by the time you get there, if we can be really, really fast, you will see that gender is represented in the curriculum, and this will make you feel more comfortable. The men need to learn these things too. So we need everybody. It's not just the women that look at gender differences. Very often the word gender comes to mean women, which is a big, everybody's got gender.
So gender analysis being imported into, it sounds like you both think the method and content of science.
Yeah.
But for a lot of scientists, that makes obvious intuitive sense to me. Some it makes a little less obvious. I'm not saying it doesn't make sense, but it's just not obvious. Take physics, for example. I mean, what would you say about the case? Is that an outlier?
The thing is that women are so underrepresented in physics that to get the combination of somebody with training in physics and someone who is really trained in gender analysis, that's a really tiny subset. So I think the question for physics is still out. The physicists need to get busy, and they need to, you know, research this, and they need to find out what the issues are for physics. We know for, you know, for 90% of science, we know what the issues are, and we know where we should work and how we should work.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, ma'am.
Hi, thank you. My name is Kelly Drew, and I am from Alaska, actually from the University of Alaska, Fairbanks. I am a scientist, a neuroscientist, and I very much appreciate the topic. I would like to confirm, you know, the idea of the way of knowing is certainly gender bias. But I'd also like to suggest that you open the discussion of the way of doing. The way of doing how we approach everything, not just about the questions that we ask and how we address those questions, but the way we manage our labs, the way we care for our people. You know, women have a different approach in their interpersonal interactions.
Give us an example. Give us one example.
Nurturing students. Women often are better mentors to students. And, you know, not only is there a gender bias, but I would like to suggest the concept of a geographic bias. I am from Alaska. And there is some significant bias, not only in the questions we ask, but the questions that are valued.
Can you see Russia from your front porch?
So, Londa, so the culture, I mean, tell us to the extent that you have a view about how the culture of science varies with male versus female. I mean, like the culture of the lab.
Well, the culture of the lab, there was a study some years ago, and it was really interesting when you had men and women in a lab, and if they weren't told what to do, it would be assumed that they would fall into the stereotypic gender roles. So the women in the lab would end up washing more of the glassware, the men would, you know, do the machines, the women would record them, you know, that sort of thing. So we need to bring this kind of perspective of what do you get new if you consider gender in the lab, and how might we want to improve mentoring for all students? If women are good at mentoring, then let's study what that is and incorporate it for all students. And teach the men how to do it, too.
Except we might be incorrigible. You never know. you're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're thinking about science and gender with Londa Schiebinger from Stanford University.
We've been looking at the role of gender in shaping and sometimes misshaping science. Coming up, we're going to ask, what can be done? What concrete steps can we take to achieve both greater justice in science and to enhance our scientific practices?
Our program is coming to you from the Mars Theater, the Bay Area's breeding ground for new performance. We'll take more questions from our audience when Philosophy Talk continues.
Missing links. Danger in paradise. Danger in paradise.
Thanks to our live musical guests, the Playtones. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. Our guest is Londa Schiebinger, author of Gender Innovations. And we're digging into the role of gender in science. We've got more questions from our audience here at the Marsh. Welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Hi, thank you. My name is Barty, and I do live here in Berkeley. Since we're talking about gender and science, or minorities in science regarding gender, just to kind of flip the other side, we've got minorities of men in particular fields as well. So something like nursing that was very female-dominated, and then you get males that come in. I'm sure they had their own set of challenges. But do you have any thoughts about that? I myself work in a lab where it's predominantly female, actually. So
What's your field?
Histotechnology.
So, Londa, what do you think of that?
Well, I'm glad you brought up nursing, caregiving, child care, that sort of thing. These are fields where we need to get more men into them. So I think nursing is it 10% of men get PhDs or something? But they often, you can't say trickle up to the top. The men often, whatever that metaphor would be, you know, they become the deans or the chairs of departments. So there's still an interesting gender bias there. And as the population ages, we certainly will need more male nurses to help male patients in ways that they would like.
So I think this is a really fascinating phenomenon. I'm going to go back to something John said. Having raised, in the process of raising a 16-year-old son, you're right. I do think for males, successful males, high-achieving males, the world is their oyster. And even when they're in a female-dominated profession, scientific, legal, whatever, even when they're more, the males
percolate. You
know, they percolate up.
Oh, thank
there's no
you.
Doubt. They percolate up. So the world is their oyster, right? But there's a thing that's happening. You know, more and more women are getting undergraduate degrees, graduate degrees, and I think we have under-theorized this whole complicated terrain of gender and cognition and achievement because we do think of the paradigm of the male as those high-achieving guys. Mm. And we've paid unattention to the other half of the Summers equation. Men cluster at the bottom extreme, and we hardly ever think about the bottom extreme.
I mean, we've never had a woman president, but think how many bad male presidents we've had.
I wonder, do you have any thoughts about that? I think we need to re-theorize. I once said we need a Hegelian Aufhebung of the whole gender studies because we've under-theorized the complicated terrain of
gender. Oh, yeah, let's have an Aufhebung. That would make me really happy.
I know, but do you have any views?
I should say my graduate application, I did a whole Hegelian thing. So I'll Aufhebe with the best of them. I think because we're talking about science, we're talking about that high-achieving group. What's really interesting about science is that if men are getting B's in courses in science or engineering courses, they will persist and they will become scientists, and you have a lot of B scientists, right? But the women, they assume if they're going to go on, they have to get A's. Mm. So they deselect themselves all the time. Now, I really would like to pay more attention to the men who are having a difficult time, and we're looking at disparities in our society. We need to look at those things and really give more support at the lower end. There are all kinds of new educational, that's a thing for another program, but ways of connecting up high school education with industry so kids see what the opportunities are and they're more or less guaranteed a job when they come out. It's a whole new approach to education.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, ma'am.
Hi, my name's Angie. I haven't heard very much about the different ways that the questions or theories get answered when you read feminist science. So the ways that the scientific questions get set up at all, which questions get set up, and when you read the feminist literature in science, it's very different in terms of things like evolution, explanation, stories, whatever. And I wondered what your different methodologies might do for that.
Well, our very first, these 12 methods that I've been talking about in the Gendered Innovations Project, this is all on the web. It's all free. You don't have to buy anything. You know, just go to Gendered Innovations. You can look at the methods. It's all based on 30 years of feminist science studies, feminist theory, all of these things. So I hope that we have incorporated all of that. Asking a different question is really important. John, you were kind of joking about home economics a little while ago. Well, women invented a science, and it was home economics, and it was to theorize the domestic sphere, which we don't do very often. And I don't mean to say that this is the only question we would be asking. And what happened, you know, women were professors of home economics. Berkeley had a whole department. And then after World War II, it all got shut down. The women got kicked out. And what they called the scientific part went into chemistry. Right? So how would science be different if we theorized the domestic sphere in the same way that we theorize a lot of other areas? The questions would be really different, and I appreciate you bringing that up.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, ma'am.
Thanks. My name is Melanie Light, and I actually have more of a, I don't know, observation. based on a sample of one, my daughter, who is now a sophomore in engineering at UCLA. And first of all, it's a miracle that she ever chose engineering, because there's nothing for, in the K-12 system here in Silicon Valley that would ever give them the idea. So that's, first of all, it's a miracle that she got there. But I am sensing this new generation, and probably the young lady from Berkeley High is part of it. They have a very, very interesting perspective about all of this. Like, what happened to my daughter is she designed this app for students at UCLA to track their meals in the dorms. So she had this guy do all the computing, but she did all the design and blah, blah, blah. It was her idea, blah, blah, blah. And then the UCLA newspaper did an article about it, and it was his application, his thing, his whatever, whatever. And I
they were using Google Translate.
Well, I mean, and the reporter was a girl. And so I told my daughter, this is outrageous. You should be furious. They need to run a correction, blah, 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 blah. And she just blew me off, like, oh, Mom, it's ridiculous. Don't worry about it. And so on the one hand, I feel like I'm worried that she is completely unconscious of all the feminist struggles that, you know, maybe the moms, we and the dads have gone through to sort of get to gender parity, such as it is. But on the other hand, she is so empowered and so sure of herself that it's like she's just not going to let this stop her. So I don't know if what your sense is of the younger generation of men and women and how they relate, but it seems like maybe we're behind the curve and they're maybe ahead of the curve.
So I teach a class on, you know, gender and science, and kids are still really interested. They want to know. A lot of them think there isn't any problem, but they will encounter the problems as they go up. You know, try to be a CEO. Great for your daughter. You know, this is fabulous. And then when she wants to be the CEO of the company, 3% of CEOs in Silicon Valley are women. So, you know, she's going to hit the steel ceiling at some point. I think it's really good for this generation. We still need to include it in the curriculum. We need to teach kids about it. At Stanford, we have a gender requirement, so everybody gets a smattering of gender. So I think we need to keep that in the curriculum. To give her the tools when she does run into it, what can she do to make, you know.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, ma'am.
Hi, I'm Dara. I'm on leave at your wonderful institution this year, but I teach, I'm a political scientist, and I teach gender, sexuality studies, politics, and African American studies at Princeton. And I guess it's more of a comment, but I think it goes to some of the questions about how much of this is about science and how much of this is about the academy. I think it was 3 or so years ago, the American Political Science Association had its first ever woman of color president, and she commissioned a study basically of sort of how political science is doing curricularly and faculty-wise, et cetera. I think it was 2011 the report was issued. At that point, less than a quarter of full-time political science faculty were female. I think about 8 or 9% were of color. And this was sort of on the heels of the 2008 election, of course. And it sort of, I think, pointed out for many of us in the discipline who study these things, as you were saying, the sort of limited field of vision, and sort of explained to a lot of us, or raised questions for a lot of us about why it was political science was kind of caught like deer in headlights, right, with Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama as the two main candidates for the Democratic nomination for president. And I just think it raises questions, I guess, about both, you know, is the problem that political science is too much like science, or is it revealing that it's not a science, but that we still have these kind of major persistent biases? And I think it's worse than some of the other social sciences and humanities, but it's not a natural or science. So,
yeah, we have persistent problems. Women now receive 58% of the PhDs in biology, but they're not there as professors. So we have persistent problems in the academy, the institutions, as you're saying. And this creates problems then in the content of the science, right? What it is we're actually studying. So it's all a part of the whole.
So, Londa, I want to ask you, we're going to make you czar of science and science education for one day.
You know, I'd rather be a princess.
I know, and you'd probably rather have it for life, but you can't. What are you going to do? What thing are you going to change in the landscape of science and gender first?
Well, the thing is that science is a process, right? And you've got to intervene in each. So It's the questions we ask, but what I'm interested in is the power of granting agencies. Agencies set policy, and that becomes what they fund. And if you ask scientists why they're doing something, a lot of them will just say, oh, we're following the money. You know, so the European Commission has done a fabulous thing. They are light years ahead of the United States. They ask everybody who applies to say how sex and gender works in the methods and objectives of their science. Cool. Where's the NSF in this? Second thing is that we need peer-reviewed journals to get on board. And they're really hopping on board. They are requiring, they have a four-step thing, you have to look at sex and gender in your paper.
And one last one.
Don't worry, I can see the signs. And then education. Why did the Google engineers make the mistake? Because we at Stanford have not included gender sufficiently in the curriculum. Stanford needs to clean, everybody, all the engineering schools need to clean up their act. Why are we not serving industry? Why are we not giving people the tools they need? We need to include this in all of the curriculum, not just the separate courses I teach on gender and science.
And that you have a big agenda, and hopefully we can get it going. And on that, I'm going to thank you for joining us. It's been a really fascinating conversation.
Great.
Thanks so much.
Our guest has been Londa Scheminger from Stanford University. She's author of Gender Innovation, How Does Gender Analysis Contribute to Science? This conversation continues at Philosopher's Corner on our online community of thinkers, where our motto is cogito ergo blogo. I think, therefore I blog. And you can become a partner in said community by visiting our webpage, philosophytalk.org.
Now, what would a gender-neutral science of speed sound like? Let's ask Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, I recently read Lean In by Sheryl Sandberg, COO of Facebook, formerly an exec at Google, and formerly assistant to Lawrence Summers at the World Bank. He was her advisor when she went to Harvard, and she also became his chief of staff at the Treasury Department, then Google, and finally on to Facebook. But how did she first get into Harvard? How did she get from the Treasury Department to Google? Her book does not talk about that journey much. She leaned in, yeah, but I'll bet Larry Summers did some leaning, too. She did pretty well for herself, which is maybe why she doesn't dwell over much on barriers put in her way, and instead on her own formula for feminist success, lean in, hence the title. Very DIY, but vague. It's kind of slippery what she means exactly. The male equivalent might be, till them all and let God sort them out. But she's too nice for that. She has kids, a husband, a career, a bestseller, and now a feminist organization. In short, she has that mythical thing supposedly wanted by women everywhere. She has it all. So she's kind of the alpha male-female, you might say. But if just one woman has it all, can all women be far behind? Should men be worried about that? If women have it all, what will be left for men to have? Do men feel threatened? I decided to go to the men's rights movement to gauge their emotional temperature. I don't know how populous the MRM activists are, but they are very vocal. They're all over the internet. I found this. So Amazon is a section called Amazon Mom that gives discounts on baby items. Why not call it Amazon Parent? See, there's something to get mad about. One fellow worried about being tricked into fathering a child posted, I think I might store my sperm in a sperm bank and just get a vasectomy. Another wondered, can you reverse circumcision? I feel cheated. There's no scientific evidence there's such a thing as porn addiction. Stop calling men you don't want to go out with creeps. That's like slut shaming. The legal system is matriarchal because it generally gives custody of children to mothers. And from a site called Community of the Wrongfully Accused, I read, because of a hateful feminist philosophy that has flourished in recent years when it comes to alleged sex offenses, we can assume guilt based on statistics. And that's why, according to some men's activists, Woody Allen is being railroaded. But is male privilege even a thing? No! That supposes all men and women are the same, like the Borg on Star Trek. A hive identity, if you will. Men's rights quote, Borgification of men and women into classes is both misandrist and misogynist. The notion of male privilege proceeds from this Borgification of men. And resistance is futile. I did finally find a comment that specifically addressed Lean In, quote, personally, I think the best thing the men's rights movement can do is to stop directing any empathy or pity towards any female at this point, unquote. Well, calm down. Lean In is more like a feel-good TED talk than an angry Occupy Your Cubicle manifesto. Her thesis struck me as, the world doesn't care much about your troubles. Don't get over that. But, you know, get over it. So, personally, I think our testosterone is safe for now. I'll see you in the man cave at game time. I gotta go.
A Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2014.
Our executive producer is David Demarest. Special thanks to Stephanie Wiseman, Erica Sokolauer-Shane, and Orr Gazal.
Thanks also to Dan Brandon and Crystal Nickerson.
The program is produced by the one and only Devin Strolovich. The brilliant Laura McGuire is our director of research. Our smooth and suave director of marketing is Dave Millar. And our creative and artistic Carola Kreitmar is our performance consultant.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University and the partners at our online community of thinkers.
And from the members of KALW, Local Public Radio, San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable. The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you too can become a partner in our community of thinkers.
I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.